We're really going to talk about two major things today. We're going to talk about the draft resiliency report that is our AMAT's first attempt to take into account some of the climate change elements that, you know, I don't mean to sound cynical about it, but that, you know, the Fed's saying, hey, how are you taking into account climate change and how is your system prepared for extreme weather events? So that is our draft resiliency report. And then Farhad is here from our staff. He will talk about the 2021 annual report on roadway congestion, which is also a new report that AMATS, this is the first time AMATS has done something like this on an annual basis to look at congestion. First, though, introductions. I'm Curtis Baker. I'm the director of AMATS.
Jeff Gardner, the AMATS staff.
Farhad Ahmadzai with AMATS.
I'm Heather Reidel with AMATS.
Daryl Kleinhans with AMATS.
Ron Brubaker with Trail Associates, Trail Advocates of Summit County.
Kay Clark, League of Women Voters.
Great. So we appreciate you being here. You know, because there's a small group, feel free to just interrupt us or, you know, jump in front of us for any conversations that we would have. The biggest things before we kind of jump generally into the agenda, you know, since the latest highway bill passed, there's a lot of discussion going on because as part of this, the BIL or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, because of this Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, it created a lot of new national grants. And so one of the things we're dealing with is that, you know, we have these paragraph blurbs of a national grant that they tell us is coming, and the only description we have is that paragraph. And now that we're getting into May and June, we're starting to see those notice of funding availabilities come out, and those notices, hey, Mr. Mackey, thank you for joining us, sir.
Welcome.
And
go ahead.
We've noticed that our, now that those notices have started to come out, our members are getting more and more interested in trying to apply for those grants, depending on what they are and what the funding allows. So current ones that are coming out are the Safe Streets Program. There is a Reconnecting Communities Program. The RAISE grants were just open. The RAISE is a really big infrastructure grant that you can get up to like $50 million for. The Reconnecting Communities grant is one that looks at, say, for example, in Akron, the Interbelt, how it subdivided a community. You know, how can we look at planning to reconnect those communities? And then the Safe Streets for All is looking at bike and pedestrian safety. So what can we do to improve our streets so that they're safe for all users? Each one of these are, you know, we are kind of introducing to our members to let them know what's available, and they're trying to get a handle on it. And every time something comes out and the NOFA comes out, then we get a little more information. But because a lot of these grants are so new, we're still not really sure what the best projects are for them, so we're trying to encourage our communities when they can to apply for them, potentially get that. With that, though, otherwise, our staff continues to work on developing our long-range transportation plan, we're going to have an update of our transportation improvement program here in the next year. This summer will, in some respects, be a quiet one from AMATS in terms of we won't probably start seeing pushing out major reports until December, more major reports until December. We will have an active transportation plan that we'll be doing soon, but it's still a little early to get started because the worst thing that we can do is finish the plan and then still have 2 years to do our long-range plan, and then so much changes between then and now. So although on the trail front, I did hear that Freedom 3 is now back under construction, the Freedom Trail 3, which comes into Akron. So that's a really positive thing for the city and for Metro Parks. So they finally figured out that those right-of-way issues. So with that, if there's nothing for the good of the order, I'll jump into our first report, which is our resiliency report. Any questions or comments on any of that stuff? All right, perfect. So Looking at 5A in our report, it's the AMATS Climate Resiliency Report. This is a draft. It's the first foray into doing any type of climate assessment for the region. Because of that, I will be honest, we don't feel as AMATS as we're experts in the field of climate change. So we had to do a lot of learning about what we thought would be the best approach. We followed a toolkit from Federal Highway about how to incorporate resiliency to extreme weather events into your planning process. We tried to use that format throughout the report to do our own analysis to determine things that were recommendations for AMATS. On the positive side, for our region, and I think you guys are probably pretty aware of this, is that from a climate perspective, our region hasn't really been greatly affected. We're not on the coasts. We're not in already like humid climates or arid climates. And when we pulled back data from 1950 to now, we looked at the main things that we felt like were most relative to transportation and what could impact us. Obviously, the biggest one is precipitation. The more weather events we have, the more potential for road washouts, bridge washouts, etc. So the two analyses that we pulled out was data from the number of days we had with rain over 1 inch precipitation in a day, and then days over 2 inches of precipitation. Really, as you can see, almost basically since 1980, we've had an uptick in number of days with 1 inch precipitation or more. Days over 2 inches of precipitation, there's probably a trend line in there, but it's not overly clear. And then we looked at our maximum average daily temperature, and really that, there's not much of a trend line. In some ways, it actually almost appears to be getting a little cooler than a little warmer based on our data for the Summit County, Portage County area. The main analysis that we did, so when we looked at the climate, we determined that really our biggest concerns are our assets when it comes to rain flow, storm water, et cetera. That's going to be, over the next 50 years, probably our biggest risk is just if there are, you know, a number of 100-year rain events, 1,000-year rain events like we have had in the past. I think the one in 2003 where we had a couple people die in Hudson was probably the last really large rain event. We're looking at, okay, how do we protect our infrastructure from those types of rain events? And so our analysis looked at our floodplains, looked at places where at the 1% chance of annual flood hazard, 0.2%. Maps include the regulatory floodway. We looked at our existing bike trail network and how they went through the how they interacted with the floodplains, as well as obviously our roadway network. Then we overlaid that with our pavement conditions, because we wanted to get a sense of what roadways do we have in bad condition that might be at greater risk of being washed out or unusable. And we identified those. And so then we sort of did a matrix of those, of looking at our regional importance based on what were some of the roadways with the highest average daily traffic that were in these at-risk areas and that also had lower pavement condition indexes. So what you'd see on page 11 of the report is that list of roadways that we think could potentially be more at risk from a severe weather outbreak. So in the report, we go through the overview of the potential solutions. We talk about all sorts of different green infrastructure, like retention, you know, everything as simple as retention ponds to permeable pavement, blue roofs. And then we actually contacted both of our engineers' offices to say, hey, how are you guys? Because them being in the townships, and a lot of times they have a lot of the responsibility of areas in the floodplains that aren't incorporated. So we asked them to give us some examples of what kind of money they're spending on a yearly basis to deal with impacts of severe weather and stormwater. And so we were able to get some cost examples of how much these communities are paying. Summit County is putting in over $1 million a year, basically, to deal with stormwater issues. Portage County is putting in $750,000 to deal with these issues. And, you know, we really just wanted to kind of provide an example of how these, get an idea of what some of these things cost. So finally, for our goals and recommendations from the report is, you know, because this is the first time we're doing this, our goal is, one of our recommendations is we want to create a goal statement in our long-range plan regarding climate change, resiliency, and severe weather. That's something that we haven't really had in our long-range planning documents, and we want our committees to codify that, saying that that is something that we are trying to improve in terms of stormwater runoff, and extreme weather. We also want to then, by taking some of the data that we have in here, try to incorporate that into our funding policy. So when we fund projects, there might be projects on the list that we provide in this report that would receive bonus points for funding because they're in areas deemed important due to our resiliency planning. And then we will be considering that probably in the next year when we update our funding policy. And then finally, we're going to be looking to push our communities to look at new roadway and transit design approaches to minimize the disruptions. One of the things that we found is that in, you know, sometimes these manuals sit around for a long time. You know, certain treatments say, oh, you only need a 4-inch pipe because of this amount of water. What we want to do is start pushing our communities to right-size the infrastructure when they build it, to say, hey, you know, that might have worked 50 years ago, but now as we're having more rain events, we need to plan for, you know, a better way to evacuate water from different areas. So, you know, we presented this report to our technical advisory committee today. We will be collecting comments on this from people over the next 3 months, and we hope to approve the plan in August after we incorporate any comments that we received. We're going to incorporate a few more local examples, like State Route 303 in Streetsboro, if you're familiar with, is a good example of a roadway that still floods, still creates detours. Barber Road in Barberton, just south of I-76 in the Norton Barberton, next to Wolf Creek, I believe, has typically been a flooding problem. And then further down in Barberton, obviously, I think it's 14th Street is where... Is that 14th? Yeah, where it's near the park that's just a floodplain, and there's lots of flooding there. But we want to try to incorporate some of those examples to help our members kind of relate the two things together. But with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or, you know, any comments.
You use the term regulatory floodplain, but it's not defined somewhere in your document. Would you explain that?
The person that wrote it would explain that to you if they were here.
Well, let me just point out, if you use a term, it should be defined somewhere. Who wrote it? What regulation?
We will define the regulatory. Yeah, but I believe it's a... Is it a FEMA?
It's on the legends of each map,
yeah.
And it's defined somewhere...
Page four. Under section two.
Oh, yeah, a regulatory floodway means the channel of a river or other water course and the adjacent land areas that must be reserved in order to discharge the base flood without cumulatively increasing the water surface elevation more than the designated height.
So, 500-year flood event and 100-year flood event, everything is... totally defined here.
Okay, all right. I missed that one going through that. I saw it on the map, but missed reading it there. Would it be...
I knew you were going to ask all sorts of questions on this one, Bill.
Would it be wise to recommend that when repaving streets, the cities, townships, county, whatever, look at a permeable pavement rather than hard concrete or hard asphalt creating runoff?
Well, in theory, yes. However, I don't believe that ODOT has approved for roadway use any permeable pavements at this point.
Okay.
And because of that, because our money all comes through the federal guidelines,
right.
You know, like,
yeah.
We have to do what ODOT allows.
So the only other option in is permeable parking lots and driveways?
Exactly. Trying to manage the stormwater on private property and,
yeah.
Essentially is the best.
Right.
I think there's a freeze and a thaw concern on that permeable. There's a freeze and thaw concern, I think, on some of that permeable.
A lot of permeable pavement in Europe when I was stationed there in parking lots. I don't see they have a problem. So we might want to look at other countries on how they build their...
It's interesting. I've seen some, like, I think Hudson has a, and where their Chipotle and Jimmy John's is, it's all paver with stone.
Right.
And they have issues with some heaving and, you know, that kind of thing. But again, you know, that would then be borne to the private developer to fix that when it happens.
And but as guidance for contractors and cities and stuff when they're developing areas to make the permeable systems the desired system and slow down all the runoff from 50 on, from 80 on. Remember seeing aerial photos of one creek feeding into Cuyahoga and what used to be a nice bend.
It's locked out.
Yeah. What used to be a nice bend is now a gravel bend because the water flow has increased so much that it's washed away the topsoil for the farm, just leaving a gravel bar up there.
Yeah.
And Fort Cuyahoga Falls has had several rain events. Flooded Route 8, flooded a house. They had to chop to a floor to rescue the people that were trapped in a basement.
Yeah. Yeah, the most recent really bad flood I remember is when the Cuyahoga Falls City Hall was flooded.
Yeah.
Holy Family was flooded. I remember seeing the videos of the water just pouring down stairwells.
Yeah. Non-permeable parking lots uphill and all that water came down in a gush there. Of course, the Cuyahoga River has washed out Riverview Road with it.
Yep. Yeah.
So there are increasing amounts of rainfall that are going to adversely impact the roadways. And I'd say if you fund for that, then you have the money to fix them, put them back to where they were, although they may go out again.
Yeah. It's funny, in the issue of Riverview, it had not yet washed out, but they closed it out of fear of washing out. And that roadway is actually not on the functionally classified system, so they had to find different ways. So, in other words, the federal government couldn't help.
Right.
But, they had to hunt quite a bit to find funding through the county engineer's office to get that road repaired. But anything in a floodplain, anything near a river or a creek is going to continue to be at risk. And, you know, the 303 example in Streetsboro is a great one because the development continues and that stormwater issue is only going to intensify as time goes on. Even if you said we never got any more rain than the average year, you're still then going to flood six times a year. We have to close the road. So I think it's a point well taken.
They continue to develop up there, too. So there are, again, more non-permeable surfaces.
Right.
And, Phil, and then, you know, Aqueduct Street over here in Akron, this way, I think, had a lot of most of the complete streets principles and one of them permeable surfaces, which alongside the street, the parking, which would be what there is part of the parking, that surface is permeable, so it seems to be holding up okay over there on that side.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know about roadways. Parking services, how we're trying to do that.
Going back to Europe, a lot of parking lots downtown, center of town, figure eight type with a hole everywhere in the parking lots.
Well, I mean, I think about like Midway Plaza off of Britton Road. You know, it's completely empty, and it is all pavement.
Right.
You know, and it's just we're paying that bill for the stormwater, and you know, nobody's even using the facility anymore. It's kind of depressing. But that's just one of many examples of that. At Seasons Road, the ride that Giant Eagle. There's a strip, and it's a huge parking lot. But it is what it is.
Thank you.
Any other comments on that? Well, if not, I'd like to hand it over to Farhad, and he's going to speak a little bit about our annual congestion report.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. So I'm going to present, and we will collectively discuss annual congestion report 2021. So this, I'm sure that Gurith had discussed congestion management process in previous meetings. So this is very similar to congestion management process report, but congestion management process report is a multi-model approach that includes transit plan, active transportation plan, freight transportation, and vehicular transportation, roadway networks. So congestion management process is a federal requirement. Annual congestion report for roadways, it's specific to roadways. Major MPOs and transportation management areas have this report. This report will help in developing congestion management process. So I'm going to talk about the report, what is the report all about, why we need this report, how we develop this report, how we are going to update it annually, and what we get from it, what are the conclusion of those this type of report. So, and how can we relate this report to other planning reports? So it's going to be our ongoing, as a part of our ongoing planning process in the future. So this report is, before we start working on this report, we defined a network for this report. So when we define a network, so we included interstates, highways, expressway, and freeways, and arterials, both principal and minor arterials, within Summit County, Portage County, Chippewa, and Milton Township of Wayne County, basically the MATS region. So this is how the network, the defined network, looked like for the annual congestion report. The defined road network, as you can see, the blue line represents freeways and interstates, and the red line represents principal arterials and minor arterials. So there are 7,100 segments in our defined network. We excluded the collectors and local streets because we have thousands of collectors and local streets. Not that we cannot scan them for the congestion, but only just we want to focus on major roads. So why we need to have this report? We have three major objectives for this report. The first one is maintaining the existing level of service. Our defined network function relatively really well. So we want to keep that existing service level of service in the future. That's why we want to keep an eye on our congestion annually. How things will change with different turmoils, such as COVID-19, people start working from home. So we will try to kind of, in the meanwhile, we will try to, we do have demand management and demand modeling issues in our planning process as well. So we will have to relate our congestion, annual congestion report, with our demand management strategies, and we will leverage our supply, the network that we have. Last but not the least is just The third objective is road traffic congestion monitoring. We just want to monitor our network as far as congestion is concerned. Do people feel good about it? So these are the three main objectives. There are a lot of objectives as far as this report is concerned, but these are the three main objectives that we want to have it in future. So the methodology of this report, the report was done using StreetLight Platform methodology data. I'm not sure how many of you have heard about the StreetLight data platform. So just it's a data platform that collects data virtually. So they collect data from two locational big data sources. They have two types of data sources. We do have navigation system. Especially when I was here for the first time in Akron, I couldn't go to my home without navigation. So I use the navigation system for my personal vehicle. And we have the navigation system installed on all commercial vehicles, like trucks. Mr. Mackey, he is aware how the trucks drive from one location to other, so they have their own navigation system.
So when I plug in my GPS mm-hmm. Garmin system, it knows where I'm at, and it knows where I'm going to be going. Mm-hmm. As I'm traveling down the road, is that being interrogated by this system?
It's being sold.
Mm-hmm. It's being sold.
That information that information is being sold to Big Brother, and many corporations buy it. It's probably worth more than your,
well,
you know.
But as far as the system goes here for us,
is it like a live action? Are you asking, like, is it live?
No, I don't want live action. You're collecting the data that I am at point A, and I'm going to travel and ask my GPS, where are you going? And, of course...
Correct. They know, right. Like, from your IP, they know that your GPS...
So it's a data collection system.
So they keep tracking all those GPS
right.
devices.
Flow and time of day.
Yep.
For some reason, like, people who do not turn on their GPS devices, they use the second type of data, which is called location-based services. So we have the cellular towers connected to our phones. We have service providers. We have a telecommunication provider. That
so if I turn off my cell phone, you don't know I'm going from A to B.
But
if my cell phone is on, you're tracking that cell phone.
Every time it pings,
okay.
They know where you are.
Correct. This is
it
what
goes into the database.
This
okay,
is
that's
what
good.
Mr. Baker means from pings. So you see the pings out there from
uh-huh.
the location-based data and the GPS navigator-based data. This is how they collect the data. It's just a small piece of data. So they collect the pings and their reading algorithms. Trust me, they are very much accurate. They are confident with the real equipments and counters. We have conducted a few studies and researches on it for validation of the data. They have more than 90% of accuracy. So
excellent.
This is how they collect the pings, and their reading algorithms convert those pings into travel patterns and trips. And they provide you origin destination metrics. They know now that Mr. Mackey started his trip from his home to library. They know that I started my trip from Kent to here. So, especially Wakeler traffic.
They also know what your income is.
I'm just letting you know.
What
college you went to. I used to be in electronic countermeasures. I'm just thinking about ways to...
Yeah.
But I won't do that.
How they differentiate if the vehicle's got four phones in it?
Well, they only know. That's a very, really good question. They track the Wakeler data. They're not in a such advancement so that they can track the vehicle occupancy as well. Vehicle occupancies can be. We can get that data from census data, but they definitely track vehicular traffic. So what we do for our planning process, we do consider vehicle occupancy kind of performance measure as well, but most of our planning process relates to the number of counts. Like, we count the vehicles, we do not count necessarily the number of people in the vehicles. But we do have that type of thing. We term it as a vehicle occupancy ratio, and we get that data from census data.
But I think in reality, they don't know. It's just, yeah.
It's a statistic.
Yeah. There could be four people in the car, and maybe they're counting those as four separate samples versus one.
They can do it.
Yeah, but I think their algorithms are smart enough to know, hey, if these four people are in exactly the same spot, it's probably one vehicle.
One vehicle.
Yeah.
And they would be able to figure that also out, that how many people are in that vehicle. Because if they can track one phone, they can track four phones as well. And they follow the same identical patterns during traveling. So that's how they do it. There's a slight difference. We know that navigation data, the GPS navigation data, is very small in sample size. That's why they use the cellular tower data, which is called, they call it location-based data. But the GPS data is very much accurate. Their precision, their location precision accuracy is... What happened?
Just pushed a button.
Did it hit the... I think it just timed out that place.
Yeah, and it timed out.
No. This was like the last time I hit that on.
The location accuracy of the GPS data is very accurate, but small in sample size. But location data, they have a very large sample size data. They have, but it's not as accurate as location. But they have their own reading algorithms to make necessary corrections as needed. So that's why they use two data sources. So they provide, as I told you before, that they provide origin destination metrics, they provide activity analysis like average daily traffic.
I bet it times out after like half.
They derive the data of turning movements from their reading algorithms. So they derive data from these two types of data sources. But what we use is, for this report, is called free flow factor, free flow speeds, and congestion. So free flow speed is the realistic speed, operational speed that people experience during traveling. They take the maximum average speed. Suppose that we have the maximum average speed for 4 months, we observe that the maximum average speed is experienced from 8 to 9 o'clock at midnight, or from 11 to 12 o'clock at midnight. So that's why they call it free flow speed. That is the maximum average speed. So they compare the maximum average speed, termed as a free flow speed, to average speed. So if we have the average speed, like I drive 70% of the free flow speed, we call it that the road is in a 30% congestion, because it's 30% less than the free flow speed. That's how MATS divides congestion into three different categories. Low congestion starts from is between 25 and 35%. Moderate is 35 and 45. Severe is above 45. So as a result, we got that our network functions really well. It functions tolerable intensity of congestion. 93% of our road segments. When I say road segments, it's just the defined road segments. Interstates, freeways, and arterials. So 93% of road segments have no significant congestion. We have 58 miles of central line, miles of road segment have low congestion, 12 miles have moderate, and only 2 miles have severe congestion.
Could you go back for a second? Mm-hmm. Just to point out, so on this map, just to orient you, you know, one of our worst congested areas is up in Streetsboro, that top right corner.
Correct,
you can see some red. You can see Talmadge Circle. West Avenue is sort of where traffic going into the circle is usually pretty bad. Portage County, the Mogador exit off of its East Avenue and Talmadge, and then I think it's just called Talmadge after that, is another area that's pretty bad. And then Howe Road and 82 in Macedonia, and then Montrose. You can see a lot of different the congestion in the Montrose area, which makes sense for a lot of us. But I just want to point that out just because I like these maps. I think it kind of, it's like, oh yeah, well when I'm driving, I know when I hit one of these areas, I'm usually going to be slowing down, especially at the rush hour times.
Yeah, you can narrow that down, couldn't you, for time?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing this up, Mr. Baker. Actually, yeah, so whenever we talk about congestion, it's just the peak period. So when you see the Talmadge Circle, so during the non-peak period, we can just go and yield to the Talmadge Circle. We can travel by free flow speed. So when there is a peak period, we will have to wait and yield to other vehicles. So that's why what we have got, whatever you see as a congested miles, so these all are obtained from the peak period. So we scan the network for 24 hours for 5 months, starting from March until August, is normal months. So we scan the entire network with 100,000 of metrics, and we filter the metrics to the peak period, and we have got all those numbers from the peak period. That's why when we talk about congestion, so obviously we have to think about the peak periods. Like we have AM, like early in the morning peak period and late in the evening. So from 7 to 10, it's morning peak period, and from 3 to 7, it's evening peak period. So when you see the congestion, it's definitely during the peak period. So in terms of numbers, we have 6,377 out of 7,100 segments that has no significant congestion. So green, we are green there, and we have 577 low congestion, not as bad as moderate and severe, and 129 segment moderate congestion, equivalent miles can central line miles is just in the next column, and 23 segments severe congestion. So segment is just a portion of road between two intersections. So, comparison by functional classification, there are 11 miles of arterial roads moderately congested, 51 miles low congested, and only 1.62 miles centerline miles severely congested, and we don't have interstate or freeways that are severely congested, but we do have 0.15 miles of interstate or freeways that has moderate congestion. So there are 0.36 miles ramp that has severe congestion and 1.54 miles moderate congestion. So comparison of congested miles, by political unit, you see Mr. Mankipega Falls is second in this ranking. So we have 7.2 miles, centerline miles, congested. So this does not include that. When you, when I say 17.2 miles, so it does include the low congestion, moderate congestion, and severe congestion. So 70.2 is not only severe. It includes all three categories. So Cuyahoga Falls is second, Hutchinson is third, Stowe, Macedonia, yeah, Fairlawn, Talmadge, and so on. So this is all our political units. So I can see that Bath Township and Conflict Township, they are 0 miles. So they are good there. So comparison by congested mile by county, Summit is there. So Summit experiences highest centerline miles of congestion, and we have Portage County, and then Chippewa and Milton Township. So this is how our congested road network look like. So we don't have an interactive map, but we can still kind of visualize things where congestion actually occurs. So we have the Talmadge Circle, and we see the downtown of each jurisdiction's Streetsboro, Ravenna. So we have East Market Street, Exchange Street, Akron Downtown, some portion in Akron Downtown. We can see the State Route 8 when it turns into a controlled route. We just have signals at the very end of State. Is it still State Route 8?
It's still State Route 8. Yeah.
State Route 8, but it's, it turns from a highway to a controlled road, so we call it technically controlled with signals, traffic lights. So the second most important performance meter is vehicle hours of delay. So along with the congestion, we do consider vehicle hours of delays for this report. So vehicle hours of delay is the additional time, represent the additional time vehicles spend by traveling at speeds other than vehicle speed. Suppose that if I travel at average speed, I spend 10 hours in traveling, and if I travel in a free flow speed, I spend 7 hours in traveling. So those 3 hours are called vehicle hours of delay. We have the threshold for from the Code of Federal Regulations. So the threshold is that all the vehicles travel less than the 60% of posted speed limit are called to be experiencing excessive delays.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep an eye on those type of performance measures in our planning process. So we have congested road network. So we have 721 segments congested, and we have 6,700 something non-congested road, and we have 7,100 segments as a defined road network. So if we consider it takes the vehicle hours of delay daily vehicle hours of delay for congested network is 19.76 per mile. So each mile has 19.76 hours of delay in the congested network.
Hmm.
So it depends on the number of vehicles. Suppose if the number of vehicles enters to that specific portion of road, which is 1 mile, if there are 1,000 vehicles going through that road, and each vehicle experiences 1 second of delay, so 1,000 seconds is there. So on average basis in a congested network, each mile of roadway experiences 19 hours of delay. But our average defined road network, as I mentioned, which functions really well, experiences only 8 hours of delay. Similarly, it takes 2,176 miles to have an hour delay. But for congested network, if we travel only 658 miles, we experience 1 hour delay. So the mileage is low for the congested network, and it's pretty much high for the defined road network. So conclusion, we realize that this is a very demonstrate a comprehensive approach for monitoring vehicular traffic. For the congestion, annual congestion report, obviously, the congestion-related performance measures, we get some good results from it. This is a comprehensive way of monitoring the traffic. As I indicated earlier, that this report will aid in developing our congestion management process report that we complete every 4 years. That one is a multimodal approach, but we can complete the roadway section from this report, roadway section of that report from this report. The results have shown that our network functions in a tolerable intensity of congestion. Even during peak periods, as I told you, we don't have a great amount of congestion. We only have 700 segments congestion out of 1,000, 7,000, and 100 segments. Even during the peak periods, our network functions really well. So coming back to our first objectives, we really want to make that happen in the future as well. We want to keep that happening. We want to maintain that existing level of service. If anything bad happens, we will inform our decision makers and our stakeholders about the congestion. And finally, this report will be updated annually, and the results of this report will be incorporated in long-range transportation plan and transportation outlook 2050. That's all from me. Any questions?
Very well put together. I like the new technology. I saw this idea years ago, but now it's implemented. Very good. On the really congested sections on page 15 and 16, you have 23 segments. And five of them belong to Talmadge, the infamous Talmadge Circle. Now, is that going to be, can that be fixed by Talmadge Department of Engineering?
So,
in other words, like we put a loop around cities, can they put another loop around the circle somewhere? Bypass? There are one road I know that you could go from north to northwest to west.
Right. They've looked at it. The cost is pretty exorbitant. And I think politically, when they've talked to their residents, the residents know how to navigate the circle a lot better than those of us that don't go through it very often.
Yeah, it is a high accident intersection.
Yeah. But it's also, you know, like, not to make, sounds like I'm making excuses for it, but, you know, the crashes there, like, it didn't actually show up on our crash report this year because of the emphasis on severity.
Oh,
and those crashes are not severe. They're fender benders,
right.
Property damage
right.
only. And I think, yeah, I think the cost was going to be over $20 million if they tried to do that. And they just, my understanding is, like, for that amount, they didn't feel the problem was worth
fixing.
Yeah, for that cost.
And Macedonia pops up three times, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that around 82, the light at 271. Mm-hmm. You know, it's.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Very good.
All right. With that, that sort of concludes our more planned element of the meeting. And now we just open it up to discussion. If there's anything anyone wants to put comments on for the record or questions, we'd be happy to address them.
I have a reference for the AMATS group, a book on bridges. I know we're going to rebuild the bridge on Route 8 over the Little Cuyahoga.
You know that I still haven't, I asked them to send me the renderings that I could send them.
Right.
And they never sent them to me.
Anyway, off the internet there are some other printouts of very nice looking bridges. I just,
that's the homeland, that's what I'm from.
And the other thing that's coming down the road that AMATS has not touched, which maybe they shouldn't touch, but here are all the new 1-4 person vertical takeoff and landing things, which will now be flying over our cities as people go back and forth to work. I mean, we're not that fast in picking them up. Some of this is from Dubai and France and whatnot, but
it's going to happen.
We're going to have traffic tax vertical takeoff taxis running around between here and Cleveland and elsewhere.
If you're telling me in my lifetime I can say this bird's got to fly and then take off.
You may see the Jetson vehicle yourself. I probably won't see it, but you may see the Jetson vehicles.
Yeah.
So for the
but that's aviation. That's the Department of Aviation.
Well, it's transportation. It's moving citizen A from home to...
Let the FAA worry about that.
Well, you've already cited federal documents in doing this study and the federal requirements, so be prepared. That's all I'm saying. Be prepared.
Consciousness.
You mentioned notices of funding available.
Yeah.
From three different sources.
Mm-hmm.
For an advocacy group like Task Force,
yeah.
Can we get copies of those?
Those are all on the Department of Transportation's website. Now, from an advocacy perspective, the applicants have to be governmental entities.
Right.
And the other wrinkle with those is that usually those that show up on grants.gov are very intensive grant applications. So typically our communities will need to spend money to hire consultants to actually write those grants because they just don't have enough boots on the ground. So I would just be aware that advocating for, say, a community to go after a grant like that, there will be, which is the same thing that we're doing, but we have to acknowledge that they might not have the staff on a smaller to do these because a lot of them are like the RAISE grant, for example, which closed in April, most communities had to spend roughly between $60,000 and $75,000 just to apply, just to be able to create all the documents, write all the documentation, all that. So there is an expense to the federal grants, which is why we don't really like them. We just wish they would have given us the money and we could have spent it ourselves.
So can some of those grants be used for trails?
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
all of them, or
it depends. Some of them, like RAISE, it would be part of an incorporated larger project that could be used for. The Safe Streets for All, my impression is that they could be. However, it sounds like they're requiring every community to first do a Safe Streets for All plan before they can apply for capital dollars, almost like the Safe Routes to Schools program at the state level. The Reconnecting Communities yet, the NOFA hasn't come out yet, so I can't say for sure. I have not yet seen a program specifically dedicated to bike and ped, but almost all of them would fund those elements as part of another project. So like with the RAISE grants, for example, Kent's applying for one on East Main Street. They want to continue their trail alongside East Main Street on the south side, on the Kent State side of where the university is. That's part of that application, is that piece of trail. But would they have applied for a RAISE grant for just that piece of trail? No, it wouldn't have made sense, and it would not have been well received.
You mentioned grants.gov. Is that the DOT website?
So grants.gov is where you would actually apply for one of those grants. So that's more for the municipalities to apply. The Department of Transportation website. So I think if you just Google Department of Transportation, where Mayor Pete resides, that would have all the information about the upcoming grants. I can set, there's like specific links that I have that I can forward to you, just so you can see them all, because there's all this, I have to be honest, it's kind of in, it's not as simple as just saying, you know, type in transportation.gov new grants and have them all pop up on your screen. So I'd be happy to send you the links.
I would very much appreciate
yeah.
it if you could send it.
And like I said, some of them, it's it'll just say NOFA coming in May or NOFA coming in July or to be determined. You know, there's a lot of them that we still don't have any information on. All we have is a little blurb that might be three sentences long. So I can send you what we have.
Pen?
Yeah, I feel like I'm better off.
Ready? Ready?
Ready?
Ready?
Ready?
Ready?
Ready? Sorry, I got it.
Oh!
You can't be prepared.
I've got ready right there.
Woo!
Yeah, give it to the staff.
Boy, that is nice.
That's better than the bridges, bro. I like the clock.
Woo! Man.
This won't run dry.
I like the way this pen signs my name right here. Nice. Thank you. That's
You're
very
welcome.
Cool.
Thank you.
But yeah, I'd be happy to send you the list of what we know so far.
That would help a lot.
And, you know, you'll start to probably feel the way I do, where you read it and you're going, okay, this sounds great, like, but can I do this? And there's no more information. It's just like the three sentences, and you're like, where's the rest? So, because a lot of these new grants didn't exist before this new bill. So, you know, not only are they, it's almost like they're trying to write how to apply at the same time they're writing what's eligible. It's just, it's a little sloppy right now.
You mentioned one community was applying. Do you see a lot of interest from the community?
Yes. Yeah. I think for RAISE, I know Kent applied, Akron applied. I think it's possible that Green applied as well. A lot of these communities apply when they sort of already have the project in the hopper, so to speak. They've done some design work on it. They've done a little bit of that prelim work so that they can say, hey, we can build this in 2 years. Because usually that's what happens. If you get the grant, you know, they put a timeline on it of you need to spend the money within such and such amount of time. So, it's rare that you could, like, a smaller community is probably not going to apply for it unless they already have done some legwork on it. Hmm. And we're still trying to figure out, so like, you have to understand, like, in years past with the RAISE grant, you know, it was almost like, okay, every state might get one job, you know, or Ohio might get two RAISE grants in an application round, but they've literally doubled the amount of money. You know, so our question is sort of, okay, does that mean every state gets two or three? Or does that mean they're going to be more focused and look at specifics and maybe, you know, we haven't seen that yet, how they're going to apply that money. Because it is kind of interesting when you look at the different projects that were applied for at the state, at each individual state. You know, if you look at them on a whole, you would say, boy, that project in Missouri is not nearly as competitive as the one we applied for and didn't get in Akron, you know. But the other wrinkle on this is that there's a political element to it. You know, they say it's a scored grant, kind of like we're using a matrix and a rubric, but what we tell our communities is if you're going to take the time to apply, you got to take the time to lobby your representation too, because they do have pull. You know, it's not just like a technocrat scoring it. There is an element of politics.
Could one of these grants be applied for on top of a project that already has TASA funding? Grant?
Yes. Yeah. You could go in saying, hey, we've already got 50, you know, you can almost say, hey, this phase is funded, but you could say, hey, we want to do even longer phase, so now we've got 50% of the funding, we're looking for the other 50%. You could do something like that. But again, I think on some of these programs, I don't think standalone trails will hold up well. When you just, when I'll send it, you'll see, like, there, you know, the raise grant itself, the, you know, like, the main, there were, like, three key things. You know, one of them was equity. That was, you know, the project had to look at dealing with issues of income, racial equity. Another one of the keys was the project had to support, you know, union paying jobs. And another was, I can't remember what the third one was. That one might have been more technical, like, improving the connections to the network. So what you kind of see in these grants is that from year to year, depending what the administration, who's running the government, it's kind of setting these benchmarks along the way of what they want to see in these grants. There's a big push on the EV side now, so for electric vehicle charging. So a lot of grants are trying to incorporate that into their application, or a lot of applications trying to incorporate that as well. So, but again, we don't know until we see how they'll award them. So that's why we're kind of trying to tell our communities, if you can, you know, consider these grants for your projects.
Well, I'm ready to go home.
All right.
This is your present. The lake.
It looks like you already read it a few times, Bill.
There's some great bridges in there.
Yeah,
great bridges in there.